Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's October 18th. We are in Parshas Kisisa. We're on page 512. And we're up to Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21. I'm going to continue a discussion here about the Shalosh Shogalim, the three festivals, and a few other halachos that are thrown in with them, that are related to them. And we're going to go through that till the end of the paragraph. And at that point, we're going to go back to discuss the broader issue, which is why these halachos are being brought here, why these laws are mentioned here immediately after Moshe Rabbeinu achieving forgiveness for us for the terrible sin of the golden calf. But right now we'll focus on what we have at hand. So we finished talking about Pesach and the related rules of Bechor, of the firstborn people, firstborn animals. And now, Sheishas Yamim Ta'avodu Vayom HaShvi Tishbos, 6 days you shall work, the seventh day you shall rest. Obviously, a reference to Shabbos. Becharishu Vakotzir Tishbos, in plowing and in harvesting, you shall rest, or you shall refrain, or withdraw. Now, there is a difference of opinion among the sages why the Torah specifies plowing and harvesting. We know there are 39 malachos, there are 39 prohibited acts on Shabbos. Why are these two singled out, plowing and harvesting? So that there are two opinions, and both require a little bit of focus. One opinion is that this is a reference to the Shemitah year. Because in the Shemitah year, whereas the other years, the other 6 years in the Shemitah, in the 7 year cycle, one is allowed to plant and to plow if it's not Shabbos, meaning during the 6 days of the week, one is allowed to be involved in all 39 malachos, all 39 of the prohibited acts of Shabbos are permitted during the week. But in a Shemitah year, in a sabbatical year, in Israel, then one cannot plow, nor can one plant the entire week, not just on Shabbos. Because the entire year, weekday and Shabbos, are part of the Shemitah year. So the way one would read the verse, according to this understanding, is 6 days you shall work, which means you can do whatever malachos, whatever types of work you want to do, you can do for 6 days. Uvayom HaShvi Tishbos, on the seventh day you shall rest. But that's only in a regular year. But in a Shemitah year, in a sabbatical year, Becharishu Vakatzir Tishbos, then the entire week, not just on Shabbos, you must refrain from plowing and from harvesting if you live in Israel. That's one way to read the verse.
Has the concept of Shemitah year already been introduced in the Torah?
Yes, it was introduced.
Thank you.
Yeah, on page 434 it was introduced.
It was
in Parshas Mishpatim, yeah. Most of these laws were introduced before. Now, our sages tell us that according to this reading of the verse, there is no need for the Torah to tell us that you cannot plow nor harvest in Israel during the Shemitah year. That's a well-known fact. It's not only said before, but we're going to have a whole parsha later dealing extensively with the laws of Shemitah. The end of Parshas, in Parshas Bahar, we're going to have a whole discussion of the laws of Shemitah. Very, very detailed. So here, there's no need for the Torah to tell us that one cannot plow nor harvest during the Shemitah year. Therefore, our sages tell us that from here, we derive the law that one must add both before and after the Shemitah year. That one is not allowed to plow prior to the Shemitah year. 30 days prior to the Shemitah year, it is prohibited to plow the land. Meaning Rosh Hashanah is when the Shemitah year begins, but a month before, one cannot plow the land. And also, one cannot harvest the crops that grow during Shemitah, even after Shemitah is over.
Is that really observed in Israel?
The ones who observe it. Yeah, the ones who observe it do it correctly. Yes. Yeah. Not everybody.
Few was it by everybody.
There's a lot of people who observe it. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people do it. It's really a remarkable thing.
Is it also a 30-day extension?
No, it's the crops that grow during the Shemitah year cannot be harvested after the Shemitah year either.
So what do you do? So what happens?
They lie in the field. Eventually, the animals get them.
Oh, okay.
You're allowed to harvest during a Shemitah year enough for your own family. A Shemitah year, the crops are hefker, they're ownerless. So if I own a field and I'm not allowed to plant it or work the land during the Shemitah year, but things grow on their own. There are seeds that fell during the previous year, and they fall on the ground and they grow. Anybody can come and take what they need for their families, including me. Just because it's my field doesn't make me any different than anybody else. Any of us can go and take what we want for our families. What we're not allowed to do is hoard it. You can't gather a lot, either to store up for a long period of time or to sell. That's what we can't do.
You can't throw it out either.
Well, that's a different issue. That's a different issue of the kedusha, of the sanctity of the Shemitah year, of the Shemitah produce. So when it says you can't harvest, it doesn't mean you're not allowed to pick an apple off the tree and eat it. What it means is you can't harvest bushels and bushels of apples and put them in your silo or your barn or whatever it is to save for whatever, for me, for the market, for the future. That's what we can't do. Yeah?
It reminds me of not being able to hoard it, just like for the manna. We're not supposed to take more
than you need. Yeah, yeah. The man was a daily ration. That's true. That's a good point.
Can I ask you a question about the things that do grow in the fields? If you can't harvest them for 30 days, can you not plow or not harvest?
Plow.
You can't plow for 30 days after Shemitah is over.
We can't plow for 30 days beforehand,
right.
And we can't harvest the crops that grow during Shemitah.
Right. So as soon as Shemitah is over, what happens to the crops that are there?
Either people take them as they need them, or animals get to them, or they rot. You know, whatever whatever happens to
them. Can the farmer, plow under what grew there and start?
That's a good question. I don't know what happens. I don't know how that works. That's a good question. You're asking if there's.
At what point can he go back to plowing?
Right. Yeah. I don't know, but I think that the natural order of how the planting season works doesn't really encounter that problem.
Okay.
But I'm not 100% sure. But not being a farmer, it's hard to know.
Well, during Shemitah year, you're still in possession of that farm.
Yeah,
right?
It's your land.
Mm-hmm. It's still your land, and you're still in possession of what's there. So suppose somebody who is not Jewish goes and wants to take the whatever's growing. Is that permitted? I mean, you're not going to sell it. They're just free to come and take
it. I mean, can a non-Jew come and take the Shemitah produce? I don't know of any source that says they can't. The thing is that, as was mentioned before, there is sanctity to the produce. That's why we have to be careful when we get produce from Israel during a Shemitah year, even now, right immediately after the Shemitah year, as produce is coming in that was harvested grew during the Shemitah year. So it does have sanctity. So that means it has to be treated differently than when we treat normal produce. Can't throw away anything that's edible. There's a whole way of handling it. It's especially prevalent with wines.
Right,
one has to be careful with Israeli
so
wines.
For 2015, there's not going to be any.
Well, no, there'll be. There'll be. Mm-hmm. Just have to be careful about them. They're Shemitah. They should say it on the label.
Okay.
Yeah, it should be marked.
But it's better to avoid any.
Well, I don't want to say it's better to avoid. If you know how to handle it, then it's fine. Right. It's just that most people don't know how to handle it, and therefore it's better to avoid. Well, that's if I knew, I would tell you. So here we have a concept of adding on before and after the Shemitah year. Now, this is a concept that applies not only to Shemitah, but we'll find other places where we have a rule of adding on before and after sanctified things. So, for example, Shabbos, there is the concept of Tosefes Shabbos, of adding on to the Shabbos day, where we begin the Shabbos a few minutes prior to sunset, even though Shabbos begins at sunset. The minhag, the prevalent custom across all types of Jews, is to light candles 18 minutes prior to sunset. The reason for that is to add on a little bit to the Shabbos. If one did not light 18 minutes before sunset, one can still light all the way up to sunset. After sunset, if one did not light, one should not light. Better not to light than to light after sunset. But if one did not light at the right time, which is the time they print on the calendars, is 18 minutes prior to sunset, one can still light afterwards. But it is appropriate to add on a few minutes, to start a few minutes prior to sunset, not a minute before, 5, 10, preferably 18 minutes before sunset. Some people have the custom to light half an hour before. But 18 minutes is fine. If a person doesn't make it by 18 minutes, 15 minutes, 10 minutes, but there should be some time added on prior to the onset of Shabbos. Similarly, when Shabbos ends, it is appropriate to add a few minutes to the end of Shabbos. Now, the truth is that because we are in doubt of when the three stars come out, therefore, if you keep Shabbos up until the moment that the calendars or the shuls print is the end of Shabbos, you have already added on some time to Shabbos, because we're not exactly sure when the three stars are, so we err on the side of caution. So therefore, we're already adding on to Shabbos. If you end Shabbos when the shul bulletin says Shabbos is over, you've already added on to the end of Shabbos. But you have the concept of adding on to the beginning and end of Shabbos. Similarly, Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, it is appropriate to add on a few minutes prior and after Yom Kippur. And that involves fasting. And with Shabbos, it just involves doing work. Yom Kippur not only involves doing work, it also involves fasting. That it is appropriate to add on a few minutes before and after. So that's one of the reasons why Kol Nidre always begins prior to sunset. There's another reason for it as well. But one of the reasons is because we presume that once Kol Nidre begins, people are no longer eating and drinking, so they've essentially accepted Yom Kippur upon themselves. The women have already lit candles, where we're already starting Yom Kippur. So it adds a few minutes at the onset of Yom Kippur. When Yom Kippur is over, assuming a person is not in a dire state of need to eat, you know, we're talking about someone who's healthy and able to handle it, then again it is appropriate to add on a few minutes at the end. And again, if one keeps Yom Kippur until the time that the shul prints that Yom Kippur is over, then one has already added on a few minutes, because again, we're in doubt as to when three stars are over. Now, of course, with Yom Kippur, because of the fact that it involves fasting, which could be a danger to health, when a person, God forbid, is having trouble with the fast and they need to eat, then of course they should eat as soon as they possibly can. As soon as Yom Kippur is over, they should eat, and there we are as lenient as we possibly can be with the timing to ensure that they eat immediately and not add on any time. But if someone is able to, it is appropriate to add on time, and we do because we're anyway erring on the side of caution with the three stars. So the same concept we have with the Shemitah year, of adding the beginning and end of the Shemitah year, we find it also with Shabbos and with Yom Kippur. The concept of expanding the sanctified time. That's what you find, that idea throughout the Torah. Now, that's one version of how to read this verse. What about the second version? Again, we're coming to answer the question, why does the Torah emphasize plowing and harvesting? If there are really 39 prohibitions, why emphasize these two? So the second approach, which is a little bit more involved, is as follows. There is a time when one is allowed to harvest on Shabbos or on Yom Tov, where it is permitted to harvest. When is it permitted to harvest on Shabbos? So we know that the Karban HaOmer, the Omer, when we count the Omer after Pesach, the reason why it's called the Omer is because the Omer begins with a sacrifice that is made on the second day of Pesach. The second day of Pesach, the carbon, the sacrifice that's brought is called the Omer sacrifice. The reason why it's called the Omer sacrifice is because an Omer's worth of barley is brought as a as an offering. So that happens on the second day of Pesach. The normally, when a grain offering is made, it has to be made of grain that has already dried out, meaning it has already dried out in the fields, because grain that hasn't dried out cannot be ground. You can't grind into flour wheat or barley that has not dried out. And therefore, it is considered to be better grain if it's dried out, which is in fact the case. When you buy your gold medal flour in the store, that flour is ground from wheat that was first dried out. If it was moist, it wouldn't grind. So it's better for grain to be dry. You have to harvest it and then let the moisture dry up, the natural moisture from the ground dry up prior to grinding it. So that's true of most, almost all grain offerings that are made in the Beis HaMikdash. The finer the flour, the better the flour is, the more finely ground it is. And so to get it really finely ground, it has to be dry. The exception is the Omer. The Omer not only is allowed to be moist, it must be moist. You have to harvest the Omer the night prior to offering the Omer. That karban, that offering, that sacrifice is brought on the second day of Pesach. The harvest takes place the night prior, which is the second night of Pesach. Now here, outside of Israel, the second night of Pesach for us is a Seder night. In Israel, it's not a Seder night. But if that night would be Shabbos, the harvesting of the Omer would take place anyway, because it's a rule in the Torah that the Omer must be harvested the night prior to offering the sacrifice. So it is. That's why the Torah, when describing the Omer, says you harvest the grain, then the grain is taken and it is roasted over a fire to get out the moisture so that you can grind it up. So that's a tedious process. So it doesn't dry naturally. Instead, you have to roast it to get out its moisture so that you can grind it and offer it the next day. That's the rule in the Torah. So the why the Torah says to do it, that's a separate discussion. But that is the way the Torah requires the Omer offering to be made. The way we know this, or one of the ways that we know this, I should say, is from this verse. Because what the verse is saying, according to the second way of reading it, is that when it says that one is not allowed to plow, so when it says one is not allowed to plow, so I just want to see one thing before I tell you this. Just one second here. Yeah. Plowing is never a mitzvah. It's never a mitzvah to plow. We never find anywhere in the Torah a requirement to plow. It's a good thing to do because you want to eat, right? But you never find in the Torah a mitzvah, you must plow. Thou shalt plow. You don't find that. So when it says that you're not allowed to plow, it's clearly talking about an act which is not a mitzvah. Therefore, we say that just as when it says you shall refrain from plowing, it is referring to non-mitzvah plowing, because all plowing is non-mitzvah. So too, when it says you're not allowed to harvest, it means non-mitzvah harvesting. But if there is a harvest which is a mitzvah, that would be permitted on Shabbos. When do we have a case of a harvest that is a mitzvah? This case of the Omer. So this verse is coming to exclude the harvest of the Omer from the prohibition of harvesting on Shabbos. It's saying you may not plow or harvest on Shabbos when it's not a mitzvah. But if it is a mitzvah to plow or harvest, well, it's never a mitzvah to plow, but there is a mitzvah to harvest, that's the Omer, then what would be required to harvest even though it is Shabbos? So that is the second way of rendering this verse, that the verse is saying, it's not referring to the Shemitah year, according to this version, it's referring to Shabbos, but it is saying that we have an exception to the prohibition of harvesting on Shabbos, and that is when it is a mitzvah, that is the offering of the Omer. That would be not just permitted, but required if Shabbos came out on the second night of Pesach. Now you should know that practically speaking, the way our calendars are set up, the second night of Pesach is never Shabbos. But that's just because the way our calendars have been set in stone, it doesn't happen. But once when we revert back to the witnesses testifying about the sighting of the moon, then it could theoretically happen that the second night of Pesach would be Shabbos. All the offerings of the Beis HaMikdash violate Shabbos, including the karbanos of Shabbos, right? The musaf that you bring on Shabbos, you have to slaughter the animal. That's done on Shabbos. We're not allowed to slaughter on Shabbos. So there are the laws that are said to be done, even though it's Shabbos, we do. But you're right, we have to be very careful to only do what we're allowed to do, because you're really, you'll excuse the pun, playing with fire, right? Because you're only allowed to do what's permitted. You can't do what's not permitted. So you got to be very careful in such a case.
What about harvesting the Omer in a Shemitah year? Do we just assume that this barley is going to grow in sufficient quantity somewhere by itself?
The requirement is to do it even in a Shemitah year. Yes, and
we're just assuming that it's going to sprout on its own somewhere.
Yeah. Yes. Well, so let me give you a little bit of a more background about the Omer. One is not allowed to harvest any grain, any of the five grains, wheat, barley, spelt, oat, rye. No one is allowed to harvest any of those grains in Israel until, now forget Shemitah for a minute, in any year, no one can harvest any of those grains until the Omer is brought. The harvest of the Omer the night prior to the offering is the first harvest of any of the five grains, any primary grain in Israel for that year. That year's crop, the first harvest is the Omer harvest. Once the Omer is harvested, now anybody can harvest whatever they want after that time. So that is true in the Shemitah year as well. Now, what happens is the Sanhedrin watches for where we have the fastest, or I should say, earliest ripening barley in the country. Now, they knew of specific areas that were most likely to ripen fastest. The Mishnayos talk about the areas close to Yerushalayim where they knew that they had very quick ripening barley in those places. So the Sanhedrin would send agents of the Sanhedrin to guard that barley. Especially during Shemitah. Because during Shemitah, you need it, right? To make sure that it was available for the Omer. Yeah. So there were always svichim. Svichim means the grain that grows on its own without planting. There was always that. There were always, you know, whenever, again, I left my overalls in Philadelphia. But there's always in any farm, if you don't plant the land, there's still going to be stuff growing, and there would be Omer. There would be enough barley around for the carbon Omer. Yeah. Then Pasuk of Beis, verse 22. We move on in the calendar year. So we've mentioned Pesach. We've now mentioned Shabbos, and either, depending how you read the verse, we've either also talked about Shemitah or we've also talked about the Omer. V'chag Shavuos ta'aseh lecha, make for yourself a festival of Shavuos, which, as we know, comes after Pesach, 50 days later. Bikurei Kitzir Chitim, that'll be the Bikurim, the first fruits, the first ripening, the first offering of the wheat harvest. Now, let me explain that for a moment. When the barley of the Omer is brought on the second day of Pesach, that permits the harvesting of all other grains in Israel for anybody. However, you can't bring those new grains to the Beis HaMikdash. Even though the Omer has already been harvested and offered, now you're past the second day of Pesach, so now all the new grains, all the new crop in Israel, I'm talking about a non-Shemitah year, regular year, all the new crops in Israel can now be harvested and consumed, But if you want to bring a grain offering to the Beis HaMikdash, you have to use last year's grain. You cannot use the new grain from the new crop until Shavuos. The only new grain you can use is that of the barley for the Omer. That's it. From Pesach until Shavuos, no other new crop of grain is brought to the Beis HaMikdash. The next time a new crop of grain is brought to the Beis HaMikdash is Shavuos. It is a wheat offering that is brought on Shavuos. And when that is brought, called the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves, when that is brought, now new grain is permitted even in the Beis HaMikdash. So that's what it means, Bikurei Ketzir Chitim, the first of the wheat harvest is now offered on Shavuos. And finally, V'chag HaAsif Tekufas HaShana, and the festival of gathering, because when you gather the grain, it's after it's been lying, you harvest the grain, but then you leave it to dry in the fields, in the sun, and then it is gathered in around Sukkot time. So the festival of the gathering is Sukkot, Tekufas HaShana, as the year turns, as the year moves on to the next year. You've turned the corner on the year, you're now headed into the next year after Rosh Hashanah, and you hit Sukkot. That's the third of the festivals. If you recall last week, I mentioned to you that when we saw the words Chodesh HaAviv, that Pesach had to be in the springtime. So I told you that was one of the sources for the need for a leap year, to add a month, as we have this year is a leap, this coming year is a leap year. And one of the reasons is to keep Pesach in the spring, because if you wouldn't add a leap year, Pesach would slowly slip backwards into the winter, and then into the fall, into the summer. Mm-hmm. So there is also a requirement that Sukkot be in the fall. And that's derived from here, because the term, the Torah's terminology for a season is a tikufa. We have tikufas Nisan. Tikufas Nisan is the spring. Tikufas Tammuz is the summer. Tikufas Tishrei is the fall. And tikufas Teves is the winter. So the tikufa, it says that the festival of gathering, which is Sukkot, has to be in the tekufa, meaning in the fall. So this is another source for that, for the need for a leap year. Shalosh piramim bashana, three times in the year, Yeira'eh kol zuchurcha es pnei ha'adon Hashem Elokei Yisrael. Three times a year, all of your males will be seen by the face of the Master Hashem, the God of Yisrael. So three times a year, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, there is a requirement, a mitzvah, a commandment, that every able-bodied male, the Torah does not require a person who can't walk, the Torah does not require a person who's too young, but any able-bodied male is required to come to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash, on Pesach, on Shavuos, and on Sukkot. The women were not required to go, although many women did historically go, but they were not required to go. Now, if you think about it, if all the men, all able-bodied men, go to Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim is not located on the border. Yerushalayim is located in the center of Eretz Yisrael. So if all able-bodied men go to the center of the country, what does that do for the defenses of the country?
They
have no protection. You can't even leave a skeletal crew. You know, the Yom Kippur War, which was a disaster in the beginning of the war, there was a skeletal crew of soldiers, even though they were overwhelmed very quickly in the Sinai and other places. They were overwhelmed very quickly because they weren't prepared for war. But there was a skeletal crew there. This mitzvah requires that there be no skeletal crew. Everybody, all able-bodied men, anybody who could theoretically fight a war, must be present in Yerushalayim. There is no one left on the borders. No one. Yeah.
Isn't is he sort of the story of these people who went for a chag to Yerushalayim and like angels and malachim guarded the field?
Well, we're about to read. You'll see the next pasuk.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the Torah says, "Ki orish goyim ipanecha," because I will destroy the other nations from before you. "Virchavtias gvulecha," and I will expand your borders. The Torah seems to be giving us a reason why it is incumbent that everybody come to Yerushalayim, because as long as we're in the wilderness and everybody's near the Mishkan, you're not that far away. But once we get to Israel and we expand our borders and people are living at the extremities of Eretz Yisrael, you're far from Yerushalayim. You don't get to see the Beis HaMikdash. You don't get to visit, so to speak, with Hashem. So Hashem says, 3 times a year, I want you here. But what about the fact that all the borders are not guarded? Says the Torah, "V'lo yachmod ish es artzecha." No man will covet your land. "Baloscha le'ra'os es p'nei Hashem elokecha." When you go up to be seen by the face of Hashem your God, "shalosh pe'amim ba'shana," 3 times a year. So the Torah gives us a guarantee that no one will covet your land. Nothing will happen. You will leave. You will go. The trip will take time to get from, by foot, to get from the extremities of Eretz Yisrael to Yerushalayim. It's going to take time, a week, 2 weeks. You're going to travel. You're going to stay. And then you're going to come back. You may be away for a month. Nothing will happen. The borders will be completely unprotected. Nothing will happen at all. Everything will be perfectly fine. You're going to come back, you'll find everything exactly the way you left it. There won't be any problems. No enemies, no petty theft, no burglary, no vandalism. Everything will be fine when you get back. And if you left your wife and the little kids at home, they'll be fine. No one will bother her, no one will bother the children, they will all be perfectly fine. That is a guarantee of the Torah. This is one of the sources that make it obvious the Torah could not have been written by a human being. Because a human being can't write this. It's impossible for a human being to write this and then expect other human beings to accept it at face value. The Jews did this regularly. This wasn't something that happened once every 50 years. This is something which was part and parcel of the Jews from the time that they came in until there were times when people were weaker or stronger in this mitzvah. But the mitzvah, when it was done properly, everybody went. And the borders were unguarded. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. Yeah?
So, if people have livestock, who takes care of milking the cows?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
Even the fields, you know, you have to, you know, watch what's going on in the fields as far as planting and everything.
Yeah, so the planting and everything, apparently the fields weathered it. The question of the livestock is a good question. That's a good question. I don't know if they hired non-Jews to do it.
They had slaves, didn't they?
Yeah, they did have slaves. They did have slaves. Yeah, it could be. That's a good question. Yeah.
Plus, we know that women could serve as shepherds.
Yes, yes. But what if the women came along? We find that very often the women did come along.
Did they travel with the animals?
There were animals that were brought, but those were for sacrifices.
Just only for sacrifices.
I mean, imagine if you were a cattle farmer, you weren't going to bring the whole flock, right?
Commercial land would be pretty crowded.
Yeah. Well, it was crowded anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Rabbi, all of this is, you know, is wonderful to know what the scriptures say. But in actuality, today, that's not occurring.
No, well, today there's no mitzvah to do it today. Since we don't have a temple, then the law doesn't apply. The law only applies when we have a temple, when we have a mizbeach, when we have an altar, which we don't have today.
I think what you're saying is that every second they're coveting everything.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's your swirl.
Yes.
And
yeah.
You're just completely shocked at the notion that things could be completely different.
Right. Right.
And if we the people in the ear.
Mikra.
Right.
the Jewish men there?
Good. That's a good question.
That's a very good question.
Nice question.
The men that were in the cities of refuge.
Yeah, they can't leave until the Kohen Gadol dies.
Good question.
That's a very good question.
All right, Mrs. Wittenberg, you get the prize for the question that's going to be asked to the rest of the call tomorrow. Glean at her. Good, good. I'm trying to remember if the Gemara actually talks about this.
That's a very good question.
Okay, very good.
What
about the people in the
refuge?
They're not allowed to leave the city.
That's a very good question.
Okay.
They're not able men.
It could be. Could be they're not considered able men. Good. I don't remember. It could be that the Gemara actually says this explicitly, but I don't remember. I got to look it up. Good. Excellent. Excellent.
But she had the answer.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand the Shemitah year is to give the land some rest so it can be used again and not completely all the nutrients and everything taken out of it. So this, you know, is a hardship on people who rely on their agricultural living. Now, people who are not farmers, if they have to bring Omer to be as an offering, do they buy it from the farmers? How do they do that?
You're talking about during the Shemitah year or during a regular year?
During the Shemitah year.
During the Shemitah year, they would go and just take grain that they need.
They
would go and take grain that they need. Anybody can go into the field.
Oh, anybody can go into their field and take what they need for an offering.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, okay. So, and then again, I see the farmers as being, having to struggle during that.
Oh, yes.
People who are in manufacturing don't have the same problem.
Well, two things. First of all, the reason for it does not seem to be to give the land rest.
Yeah.
It seems to be the reason for it is to increase our trust in Hashem and to take a year off away from being involved in our livelihood and focus on our spiritual connection to Hashem. That seems to be the reason for the law of Shemitah. I can't say it's the reason. The reason is because the Torah says so, as are all mitzvahs. But the understanding that they give is that it's meant to pull us away from our focus on livelihood and focus on Hashem. Normally, we have to be focused on livelihood because that's what the Torah expects of us. But in the seventh year, the Torah does not expect that of us.
Okay, so
and that's why when we learn about Shemitah, which we're not there yet. This is just a peripheral mention of Shemitah. But when we learn about Shemitah, we will see that the verses say explicitly that if you keep the Shemitah year, you will get a bumper crop in the sixth year, which will cover you for the seventh year.
Okay, so people who aren't farmers
don't
have that.
Right. So you have to keep in mind that we live today in a little bit it's a little bit of a fairyland because we go to the store and there's the food. It's got to come from somewhere. So when you live the way we live, we're so detached from the land. So it's possible for one segment of the country, a very small percentage of the country, that is those directly involved with agriculture, to feel affected by the Shemitah year, and the rest of the country doesn't even notice it. That's possible. In a society where you live off of the crops of that year, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. Everybody is affected by the Shemitah year. Everybody feels the effects of the Shemitah year because the agriculture is what runs the country. So if there's no farmers working and there's no truckers trucking there's no hired hands. The entire country really comes to a halt in many ways. You're right. In today's way that we do business, things are a little bit different. It remains to be seen what will happen, please God, in the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A very interesting article. What if you look at the stock market, like 7-year cycles, and sometimes, funny how it works, is right on this midday year when you have those downslopes.
Oh, really?
So that's where I went wrong. So Shemitah applies to the the Holy Land, to Israel, not to Poland.
It only applies to Israel. Yeah, it only applies to Israel. That's another reason why today things are different, because there's so much importing and exporting that goes on.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Is that why we have Yashan, because we're trying to connect with?
Yashan is not, has nothing to do with Shemitah. No, Yashan is every year.
Every year.
You can't use the new crop until after the.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
That goes with the not being able to bring the harvest until after.
Yes. Yeah. That's correct. That's right. Pasuk Chaf Hey, verse 25. Lo sishkat al chametz dam zivchi, do not slaughter on the chametz the blood of my sacrifice. So what does that mean? We had this before. What this means is that you're not allowed to slaughter the Pesach sacrifice until you have first gotten rid of all the chametz. We know the rule is you have to rid your chametz. You have to rid chametz from your possession. Erev Pesach, the day before Pesach, you have to get rid of all your chametz. We search for chametz the night before Pesach. So Seder night is on the 15th of Nisan. We search for chametz on the 14th of Nisan, the previous night. And in the morning, we burn the chametz, and we eat our last chametz. And then we cannot eat chametz anymore. We have to have gotten rid of chametz by midday on Erev Pesach. The reason why you have to get rid of chametz by midday on Pesach is because the sacrifice, the Pesach sacrifice, can only be offered after midday on Pesach.
I can't imagine that.
Right. So here the Torah is saying you have to get rid of your chametz prior to offering the Pesach sacrifice. Now that was a real scene. That's something which is, as Mrs. Kaiser just said, it's something which is very difficult to imagine. That with all of the pressure and the craziness that goes on in our homes before Pesach, imagine having the additional pieces, the additional parts of traveling to Yerushalayim, and this would be the women as well, because the Pesach sacrifice is for everybody. So everybody's got to travel to Yerushalayim. Imagine the traffic. Imagine the gridlock. I mean, everybody's got to come to Yerushalayim, and everybody's got to bring a sheep or a goat. Not everybody, because you have a group, but every group has a sheep or a goat, and they all have to get sacrificed in the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan.
How do they all get home?
They stayed in Yerushalayim. You have to eat the Karban Pesach in Yerushalayim.
Okay, gotcha.
Can't eat it out of Yerushalayim. So they're all there. Imagine the hotel business on Erev Pesach. So the truth is that the psukim tell us, the verses tell us that there was an area around Yerushalayim which David HaMelech left open for people to pitch their tents when they came to Be'ol Narekel. When they came to Yerushalayim, they would pitch their tents. There was a whole open area within the perimeter of Yerushalayim where they would pitch their tents. So the chametz has to be gotten rid of prior to offering the Pesach. And that's the way you read this verse. Don't slaughter on chametz, which means while you still own chametz, the blood of my sacrifice. Don't do that. You have to get rid of the chametz first.
Weren't they leaving? So, like, leaving your house for the whole time?
Yeah, but, yes. Yes.
So you didn't have to clean anything. You just left.
Well, when you leave, you still have to get rid of your chametz. Unless you sell everything to a non-Jew. If you don't sell to a non-Jew...
I forgot that
part. Okay. And don't leave over until morning the sacrifice of the holiday of Pesach. Like all sacrifices, there is a time limit for how long you have to eat the meat. And we know that the Pesach sacrifice, you have to slaughter in the afternoon, and you only have that night to eat it. That's it. And it's got to be done by morning. This is one of the reasons why it is appropriate to complete eating the Afikomen on Seder night before I don't want to say midnight because I don't mean 12 o'clock. I mean the middle of the night. The halachic midnight. Because the afikoman today represents the Pesach sacrifice, the carbon Pesach, because we don't have the carbon Pesach today. So it is appropriate to finish by the middle of the night, because anything that takes that you have all night to do, our sages were concerned that if you waited until past the middle of the night, you might actually fall asleep. I don't know why they were concerned about that. So therefore, all nighttime mitzvos that must be completed by morning, they backed you up. And they said, you know what? Finish it before the middle of the night. Don't wait past the middle of the night. This is true for men who must recite the Shema at night. It's part of davening Ma'ariv. There is also a requirement that it be done before the middle of the night, even though really the mitzvah goes all the way till morning. But our sages were concerned, you'll come home, you'll have a snack, you'll read a book, you'll put your feet up, you'll take a little nap, and before you know it, the sun comes up and you've missed it. So therefore they said, you got to do it before the middle of the night. Same thing with the eating of the Karban Pesach. Reishis Bikurei Ad Mascha, the first of the Bikurim, the first fruits of your land, Tavi Beis Hashem Elokecha, you shall bring to the house of Hashem your God. We know this applies to those fruits that are, that I don't want to say fruits, because when we say fruits, we always think of like apples and pears. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about produce. This includes wheat and barley. So it's the first of those produce that Eretz Yisrael is considered to be blessed with. So that's wheat and barley. Let's see if I can get them all. Wheat, barley, grapes, olives, pomegranates,
dates,
figs, and dates, right? Those seven, that wasn't the proper order, but those are the seven. So the first ones, and this is not done by the Sanhedrin, this is done by an individual farmer or anybody who has any of these things growing on their property. So if you have a fig tree growing on your property in Israel, then you inspect it prior to the new season. And as you see new figs growing, you tie a little string around the shoot so that you'll know which one it is. And then when it's nice and ripe, you harvest it and take it up to Yerushalayim. Usually it was done Shavuos time. That was the most likely time to bring the Bikurim.
Literally is the first, not several of the first.
It's the first one.
One of each thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, in theory, I guess there'll be a couple of them. And they're given to the Kohen. The Bikurim goes to the Kohen. And then finally, Lo Sevashel Gidi Bachaliv Imo. Do not cook a kid, a goat or a sheep, or any kind of young animal, is what this means, in the milk of its mother. We derive from here not just the milk of its own mother, but that all meat, meaning the meat of a kosher, the meat of a goat, a sheep, or a cow, those are the only animals it applies to, the meat of a goat, sheep, or cow may not be cooked in the milk of a goat, sheep, or cow. So one cannot cook those two together. We don't cook or eat fowl with milk, chicken, turkey, we don't do that either. But that is Durabban and that is rabbinic. We don't cook with milk. We don't use it for deer, for venison either. But that is also only Durabban and that is rabbinic. From the Torah, it only applies to sheep, goats, and cows, and their milk. That's what it applies to.
What's the connection between going from the festivals?
Okay, so that's what we need to deal with right now. Yeah. Right, right.
And is this also that they can't be killed on the same day?
No.
I've heard that somewhere.
No, what you're saying is correct, but it's not from here.
Okay.
Okay. Now, just this law of not milk and meat is mentioned several times in the Torah, and that's because there's many details that we derive from each time it says it. For example, we derive that you can't cook, you can't eat, and you can't derive any benefit from milk and meat. That's one thing that we say from the fact that it says it so many times. And there are other rules that are derived from the fact that it says it several times. Yeah?
Rabbi, how can you adapt that to the modern era?
No. Adapt to what?
To the whole thing, to the modern era.
Okay.
It's almost impossible.
Well, we can refrain from cheeseburgers. Right? That we
because
can do.
It doesn't really apply to the current.
Okay. Okay, so before we do that, let's focus on why the Torah is commanding it here. Let's deal with that first. So, the Torah, the focus of Parashas Kisisa, which we've been doing, even though we had a multi-month break, but we've still been doing it for many, many months, was the sin of the golden calf. And the reaction of Hashem, the reaction of Moshe Rabbeinu, of the Levim, of Aaron, and achieving atonement for that sin. That's what we've been talking about. And when that ended, then the Torah launches into these mitzvos, the ones we dealt with last week, and the ones we dealt with tonight. And the question is, why these particular mitzvos? So we mentioned last week that the ones we dealt with last week centered primarily around idolatry, paganism. And that makes a lot of sense, because the sin of the golden calf was
idolatry,
paganism. So it makes sense that now that we've achieved atonement, Hashem says, as we mentioned last week, okay, I don't want us going back there. We're done with that. No more. Once is enough. We're finished. Don't ever do that again. That makes a lot of sense, that the Torah would emphasize this mitzvah, even though we know it already, but the Torah is trying to tell us, like, you know, you did it once, don't go back there. But why does it segue into the three festivals and their related mitzvos? Bikurim, Bechor, the firstborn, the different sacrifices, all of this are related to the three holidays, the three festivals. Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, the Shalosh Regalim. Why does the Torah now circle around to that? What does that have to do with the golden calf, with idolatry, that we now circle around to these three festivals?
Yeah, because late in the future, when you have the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes, Jews are forbidden to go to the 10 tribes, forbidden to go to Shalom for Shalosh Regalim.
Okay, that's true. That's true. Okay, so let me expand upon that. You're right. Let me give a little bit more background than that. There are different explanations given. I'm going to offer you one of the explanations that I saw, which I think is very nice. And that is as follows. You see, depending on what you worship, all forms of worship, doesn't matter what religion it is, there's only one true religion. All the other religions are false. But all religions, whether it's the true one or the ones that are made up, they all have holidays. All of them. Every religion has its holidays. You go around the calendar for various cultures, mm-hmm. and they have different holidays on those calendars. Mm-hmm. All religions do. Which makes sense, because the sanctity of time is something that is innate. There are sanctified places like Yerushalayim, like Hebron, where the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. We have sanctified places. The Shul is a sanctified place. The Beis Medrash is a sanctified place. We have places that are sanctified. We have people who are sanctified. The Kohanim are sanctified. Then there's sanctified time. There's times that are sanctified and times that are not sanctified. Shabbos is a sanctified time, and that is innate. It is not something that was made up by people. That is true, that sometimes there are times that are more holy than other times. Any human being recognizes this, that there are more important times than others. Even purely secular people have times that they view as being special, whether it's times that they get together with their family, whether it marks a particular birthday anniversary, whatever it is, people mark time as a special thing. And also that's how we live our lives. We look forward to the next event. That's how we live. It's very rare you find a person who doesn't think about the next big event in their lives. Whether the next big event is as commonplace as a get together with friends, or whether it's really a truly big thing, a wedding or something like that. But people are always looking at milestones, at the next thing in their lives. When if the Jews were to worship, God forbid, something other than Hashem, that would be reflected in the holidays, in what's considered to be a special time. And the Torah is saying, Hashem is saying, you got to let go of any kind of worship but Hashem. A reflection of that is, these are the holidays. These are the happy times. That's what you look forward to. This is what you make into a happy time. A holiday is only what you put into it. If a person does not put effort into making a holiday special, it won't be special. And we do it. We do it every Shabbos. We put effort into making Shabbos special. And every Yontif, boy, do we put effort into making it special. All the effort it takes to make a Yontif. But that's because if you don't put effort into it, it's not going to be special. And Torah is saying, if you're worshiping Hashem, these are the holidays. Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. Now, there are two others. There's Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but they're kind of separate. They're a different discussion. But the holidays of celebration are Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, and that's when you should celebrate. That's the time to celebrate. Not, should I name names?
No.
Not January 1st. Right? Or anything else. The times that you are to celebrate is Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot.
Yeah. And Hashem commands us to be happy. We're commanded to be joyous in those holidays.
Yeah, that is true. Okay. Mirz Hashem, next week I would like to finish Kisisa. We have one more paragraph to go.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.